You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Robin Whittaker.
Hello, I'm Fran Barber.
And this is the episode for the second week of Lent. Fran and I are going to be talking about Genesis 15, 1 to 12 and 17 to 18, Philippians chapter 3, verses 17 to chapter 4, verse 1, and the Gospel Luke chapter 13, 31 to 35. Just note, some lectionaries give you the option of Luke 9 for this week for the Gospel, and if you want to preach on that, we have other episodes you can find on our website to do with the Transfiguration text. So, Fran, Genesis 15, out of the blue in the lectionary, we're back in Genesis.
Yeah. I think in terms of contextualising this passage, as far as preachers might be concerned, it's really the key connecting chapter is chapter 12, where Abraham, the covenant with Abraham is made. Mm. Go from your country, I will make of you a great nation. There's a promise of offspring and the impossibility of that given Abraham and Sarah's age and so on. What then does happen is Abraham acquiring a lot of wealth. He falls out with Lot and several other people and there's quite a bit of violence. So this covenant and it seems more remote, really.
Yeah.
Shortly after chapter 12. So then we come to this very peculiar vision. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision.
Yes. And that language is telling readers we're in this prophetic manner of speaking when the word of the Lord comes, right? You're about to receive a vision or an oracle or something. So we're very firmly in that kind of the way that God communicates, we're expecting some kind of revelation. And then the greeting is fear not or do not be afraid, Abram, which again often preempts the giving of good news, actually. And we know that perhaps best from the New Testament where angels will greet with fear not or do not be afraid, I bring you good tidings. So there's lots of little literary signals here that we're going to expect some kind of revelation from God, and it is actually good news.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about the sort of activities Abraham's been engaging in the previous chapter, I don't think he's got a lot of fear in him.
No,
but certainly as a pattern and a paradigm for how God interacts, that's the message.
There's lots of interesting images for God throughout all the readings today. But one that struck me here is God introduces God's self as I am your shield. So if you were going to play with images of God today, we're going to get to Mother Hen in Luke. But that could be one thread you pick up is these different ways of imagining God, and a lot of them in these readings are around protection. And the translation of your reward shall be very great is not great. Sakar there means something you'll receive. So I guess rewards are that, but it's not like a reward because well done, you get a prize.
I do think it's a misleading term to use here.
I think in our context it tends to mean like a prize for good. It's more like what you will receive will be great, not because he's worthy.
No, or worked really hard for it. In fact, he's doing a bunch of stuff that was not really in line.
Yeah, exactly. What follows, and another thread I think we see in all the readings today, or particularly this one in Luke, is lament. So Abraham, who I'm not always very sympathetic to, I have to say, Fran.
Well, we've alluded to why that might be.
Yes. But if we read this sympathetically, you can read this as a genuine heartfelt lament of Abraham saying, Lord, you know, I'm going to the end of my days childless, like his great hope for children for what was promised in chapter 12 has not come to pass yet. And the mention here of the person who will inherit all this wealth he's now accumulated is his slave or servant in the household. So there is a real sense, and of course reflecting a worldview at the time, one that's still very prevalent, that biological offspring and someone to pass on your family name and wealth too is kind of one of the big core things of life.
I think there is that psychological aspect to what's going on here, but I think probably the more important message is the ongoing human impossibility of what you're promising continues to confound me. The gap between what God is promising and what I as a human being see before me is so vast that I'm losing it with you, God, kind of.
Yes,
you
yes.
know, I feel like that's the reiteration that's happening in these couple of verses.
Yeah, and we could, I mean, I use the word lament, but we could equally interpret this as a complaint.
Yeah.
And the, there's a fine line between the two in the biblical tradition. Yeah.
And God reassures him, saying, no, this person will not be your heir. And then there is quite an evocative picture in my mind anyway of leading Abraham outside and looking up at the sky. There's the vastness of the sky in the desert.
Yeah.
And the magnificence is very, very, it's a very poetic image and very evocative of possibility, really.
Yes, and one we can imagine, because I think we've all looked, if we can see, we can looked at the sky and seen the vastness of the stars. Earlier, I think it's in chapter 13, with a similar promise, the image there was of dust, your children shall be as numerous as the dust. Now we're getting a look to the heavens and the stars. So shall be your seed, says God. And we're told that at this point Abraham trusted God and it was to his righteousness or his merit that he did so. So Paul, of course, will pick up on this.
Romans, yeah.
Yeah, talking about the faith of Abraham, that he trusted in God to do these things.
And that we are embraced within that, that it's not actually our own seeking after righteousness that makes us righteous, but it's our participation in that of Abraham and the faith of Jesus.
Yeah. Now, I think the fascinating bit of this is when we get to the weird bit.
Yeah, it is pretty weird. And there is a sermon that comes to my mind when this passage comes around each year, and it's by Fleming Rutledge in her book called And God Spoke to Abraham. And I've forgotten the occasion of this sermon she writes, but she's got one on this passage and really quite evocatively describes this really ancient ritual of covenant. Very bloody. I think it's called This Bloody Passageway or something is the name of the sermon.
Okay.
But you probably know more about than I do what actually is.
Well, we have other parts of the Bible that talk about these kinds of rituals. And the idea is these animals are cut in two. And of course, the word in Hebrew for when you make a covenant is the word to cut. Mm. You karat a covenant. So, and it's because of rituals like this. So it's kind of gross to our modern ears if we don't, aren't around the butchering of animals. But animals are cut in two and split, and there is a path between them. So it would be messy and stinky and bloody. But the idea is that two people making the covenant would walk in between, and the implication of that is if they break what they've just pledged to, they deserve the same fate as the animals, that is to be cut into and have their guts spilled out all over the desert or whatever. So the astonishing thing here is that God is basically pledging that I will die if I do not keep this covenant with you. Like that is, it's, you know, this is normally a covenant between two humans, so God is quite anthropomorphic at this point in the story. But this sense that God is pledging on God's very life.
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to recall, I should have reread this sermon, but is it both parties who go through that passageway, or is it that the weaker one goes first? There's some other detail to – I need to go and reread her sermon, folks, but I think there's something deeply also evocative about how the Lord goes through this passageway here, but actually it should be – in the normal course of this covenant, it should be Abraham as the weaker party who goes first. And it isn't, it's God. So that's an even more underlining of God putting God's self in the place.
Yes. Yeah, so we've got that, and then we've got some great – dark night kind of falling on Abraham. And the lectionary does skip a few of these. We've got other images that come in here that are probably from the Mount Sinai story. So God sort of, you know, there's a flaming torch and a smoking kind of thing. These are, again, images for divine presence. And the lectionary sort of skips down to 17 to 18 where we get that, the summing up phrase, on the day the Lord cut a covenant with Abram, to your seed I've given this land, and we get a description of the land. of course, so I think theologically this is a really interesting thing. We're also preaching about a covenant of land in a context where that land is being highly disputed. And quite recently in America, there have been some leading pastors actually at a Christian convention in Tel Aviv just in the last couple of weeks where they referred to passages like this as evidence for, and I think the language they used was that Israel has a title deed to this land. Like what God gave all these years ago is absolutely theirs, and that justifies Israel's expansion into West Bank and so on. And the pushback to that is that we don't read the Bible in those kinds of ways, right? This is not a legal document. This is an ancient story written down much later, talking about how people ended up in that land. And to read it in that sort of predictive and very legalistic sense, I think, gets us into all sorts of problems.
Well, it's a bit like deciding to read the first creation story as
literal.
Literally how things are.
Yep. And if we are going to, I mean, I'd probably personally avoid it, but if you are going to go into like how do we grapple with this gift of the land to this particular people, I think we need to go beyond this very specific passage to look at the much bigger story and to passages like Exodus 19 that talk about, where Moses talks about, you know, we were given this land as God's chosen people, but to be a blessing for all the nations, right? So it comes with a moral obligation.
Yeah, well, I was going to emphasise that actually. It's not an acquisition out of earning it or fighting hard enough for it. It's as a blessing to the nations.
Yeah.
So it's not the same as some sort of triumphal win over something.
Yeah. So just being a bit careful about that. I mean, the other thing is within the flow of Genesis, we've just left the first 12 chapters of Genesis, which are very kind of mythical, where we get the grand stories of creation and then flood and recreation and all of this, including the Tower of Babel and the scattering of people to different languages. So what's imagined here at the end of this passage, where all these different tribal groups are named with different languages, is that this is the world, and out of all this diversity, God has chosen one people to be like a priestly kingdom, but again, to be a gift to all of those now scattered and diverse people. And so there's a narrative logic going on here too.
And this is the culmination out of the cycles of violence in those chapters of Genesis.
Yes.
You know, actually it's not about domination and so on.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of that.
Mm. Anything else to say about Genesis before we move on, Fran?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think so, except that we obviously as Christians think of Jesus as that bloody covenant that, you know, the culmination of God's covenant with us.
Yes.
Is present in the messy violence of Christ's death and the jubilation of Christ's resurrection.
Yeah. Yes, I think if we let the lectionary inform the way we interpret texts, for me this pledge of God's willingness to die, which of course we will see as Christians claim in Jesus Christ, but this willingness to die, you know, for the sake of the people and to keep a covenant with the people is, you know, obviously one theme you could pick up given where we are in the lectionary year.
Yeah, and I would say that I think how radically offensive this must have sounded is something lost a bit on us when we think of the pagan religions of the time, where it's the people coming to sacrifice animals and to appease these gods.
Yeah.
And you are at their mercy at every level for a god to then say,
"Yeah,
I will be in place of this animal for you," is so nonsensical and world-shattering. Yeah. I think that could be lost on us 2,000, 4,000 years later.
Yeah, you're right. We should say in the ancient Near East, other gods did not cut covenants like this. They made demands and people appeased them.
So the fact in fear.
That, yes. So the fact that in the Old Testament we have numerous covenants like this where God enters into these covenant relationships is something really unusual in its ancient context about the nature of this God and God's vulnerability and desire to be in relationship in a very different kind of way.
Which does throw into even starker light the do not fear message that precedes God's good news, which is because fear is the modus operandi in relation to other worship. So the lament over Jerusalem in Luke chapter 13.
Yes.
At that very hour.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's very dramatic, this passage.
So what's preceded this is that Jerusalem has not been a terribly hospitable place for Jesus or for prophets generally.
Yeah.
And at that hour is also about the overthrowing of those who appear to be first in line in verse 30, just before this passage. So Herod or the Pharisees, the holders of the first seats, will react violently to what Jesus is saying.
Yes, we've got that first shall be last shall be first segue. Jesus has been starting to make his way towards Jerusalem already in Luke. That's something that takes many, many chapters. So we've got, you know, if you go back about 10 verses, in 22 it says Jesus was going from one town to another, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem. So, of course, in Luke's gospel, as in many of the others, Jerusalem is the place associated with his death. So when he sets his face and begins to walk towards Jerusalem, it is always also symbolic of his walking towards his death. And we get lots of – so the at this hour
– refers to the death.
Yeah, the reference to 3 days. So I'm casting out demons and healing the sick, and on the third day my ministry will be complete. I think in Luke's gospel the third day is the day of resurrection. And particularly in Luke's theology, that is – the completion. It's not the death.
No, it's
not the resurrection. That's the completion.
And it's not a chronological designation. It's a theological one about salvation.
Exactly. Yep. It might be worth saying here too that Jerusalem functions, you know, it's a laden word. So yes, there's in the historical setting, there's a geographic town at the city of Jerusalem in mind here.
With a temple in it.
With a temple. So with a temple in it at the time of the narrative, but not at the time Luke is writing. So Jerusalem has this history of being hostile to some of the prophets. It's actually not true that no prophets died outside Jerusalem. But certainly, you know, Jerusalem has a mixed history and the people have had to repent because the temple's been corrupted and all of that, if we go back into the Old Testament. But Jerusalem is also this promised place. It's Mount Zion. It has this eschatological future dimension of the culmination of God's kind of gathering of people to God's self. So it's functioning. So we've got, it's this huge notion. It's not just about geography, and it's
really that the human conundrum of failure to receive God's message in the one city. The fact that that is the locus of God, the centre of worship on of God's revelation.
Yeah, and where God dwells.
And where God dwells. Yep. And yet it is also the centre, perhaps, of human beings refusing to acknowledge that.
Yes, and if we go forward to Acts, particularly in the Luke Acts narrative, it will be the place at Pentecost where the Spirit is given and the good news proclaimed and from where the gospel will grow.
Yeah.
So it is all of those things.
So it's, yes. It's,
yeah. What else do we need to say about this?
Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. Interesting whether that's actually the Pharisees having his best interest at heart, Jesus, or whether they actually just want to get rid of him.
But it could actually be not all Pharisees were against Jesus, and here there could be some who are actually trying to warn him about a common enemy, like Herod would be a common threat to.
And relative to Mark and Matthew, Luke isn't as opposed to the Pharisees as the other two Gospels.
No.
A bit more gentle towards them.
Yep. And Jesus is quite dismissive of this threat. So the whole thing we were just talking about Jerusalem and, Jesus is a bit like, she'll be right, mate. You know, a prophet can't die outside Jerusalem. I've got time yet. I'm doing my thing. Very much this sense of it's in the hands of God and, you know, like a human won't interfere with what's already been sort of foreordained in a sense.
Yeah, but the today and tomorrow, repetition of today and tomorrow, there is something comprehensive about that. repetition from him. I'm just going to keep doing these things, irrespective of the threat that you say is here.
Yeah. I really like that because that's a theme you could pick out. Yeah. That when the world is threatening violence and conflict.
All the time.
All the time. you know, today and tomorrow I do my work, which is actually casting out evil and healing the sick, like good works of bringing wholeness to other people. Like the message that today and tomorrow we just plod on and keep doing our work.
And there's the necessity messages here in the must be verb that is also used in chapter 24.
The day. At his death. It is necessary.
It is necessary. So there's a necessity that's driven through this language as well as the comprehensive time of it.
Mm. And then we get to the lament proper in sort of verse 34, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to it. I love this image of Jesus sort of saying, you know, as the mother hen that gathers the chicks under her wings. It's both beautifully protective and gentle, and as someone who's slightly scared of chickens, you know, not without some teeth. Right? No, like, I mean, chickens can be ferocious at pecking if they're protecting.
Probably not as bad as ducks.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Or geese.
Or geese. They're probably worse.
But we digress. Yes.
So this image of protection, as you say, is often in the Old Testament used about God, God's self, and Jesus is talking about himself.
Yes.
In that same
Yeah.
Why?
There are psalms, I think it might be Psalm 8, but I didn't check. But there are psalms that talk about God gathering the people under his wings. So this idea of God with wings that action of gathering and protecting is something you could play with.
And I hear more a tone of sadness about this tendency of Jerusalem from Jesus here.
Yeah.
Not necessarily accusing, but sadness about it. See, your house is left to you, which... if we could might just skip over those words, but it's basically Jerusalem is left to its own devices, which is an horrendous idea for the time.
Yeah.
That God just leaves, you know, and that will be a reference to the destruction of the temple that those reading and hearing this gospel will have known about.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Experience.
So remembering this is written probably right at the end of the first century. Jerusalem has been destroyed by the Romans. The temple has been burnt to the ground. And so this sense of you didn't recognise, and I don't mean you, the Jewish people, but you, the establishment, did not recognise the prophet in your midst.
And that's what happened.
And
you were left.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's pretty direct stuff.
Yes, it is.
Around what choice are you making to listen to this prophet?
Yeah.
And or not.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we get the next striking quote, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, from Psalm 118, which we will then hear at the palm from the crowds.
Yes.
On Palm Sunday.
Yeah, on Palm Sunday, yep, in our lectionary, but coming up several chapters later in Luke. So the crowd in Luke – and Jerusalem here, in a sense, also stands in for a kind of a crowd. Jerusalem's almost a character, and the crowd in Luke is a character. So that the crowd that will cry, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, will also be the crowd who cries, crucify him. And then we will get a crowd in Acts that ask, what is this good news? And apparently massively convert and receive the Spirit. So, you know... in the grand, I know I keep saying this in both these texts, these grand meta-narratives that we need to continue over multiple chapters and books, is that the crowd or the people are never just one thing, and that there is always the possibility of redemption.
Fickleness and redemption.
Yes.
Fickleness by the people, but redemption from God. I was just thinking too, in terms of the characters here, that Herod's a fox and Jesus is a hen.
Yes.
You know. I suppose you don't want to read too much into that.
But no, but I think that's how the image would work, right? Because the foxes, anyone who's had a hen I've looked at getting hens in my backyard, even though I'm slightly scared of them. But we have foxes in our area of Melbourne, and you would have to like build one of those proper.
We did
hen houses.
We did have chickens that.
And did the foxes get them?
No, they didn't. And we gave them away at some point because we were going travelling, and they did get eaten at the next establishment.
Yeah. So these are classic enemies, right? Mm. And the image of a fox that's going after someone versus a hen that protects its own.
And the destruction of that hen by the fox. And I'm just thinking of the Abraham reading, the bloody passageway.
Yes. Yes, there is. Lots of animals and lots of symbols going on in these passages. Yeah. But let's have a quick look at Philippians chapter 3, starting at verse 17. Now, Paul here might sound a little bit arrogant if we haven't read the first few chapters.
I was going to say that.
Sorry, stole your thunder.
No, it's all right. But join in imitating me. You know, we don't like that.
Yes.
To be told anyway.
Yes. Look at me. I am so good. Imitate me.
And you'll be right. But yes. He has asked you to imitate other people prior to this in the book, in the letter.
He has. So there's something and he's tapping into an ancient kind of normative way that you know philosophers and rhetoricians and teachers would have with their disciples, which is you learn by imitation, right? So this imitate me is a classic kind of acceptable pose towards the one you want to learn from. And but of course for Paul it's because he's imitating Christ, and it takes us back to that Luke reading. The Christ he's imitating is the Christ who suffered and died on a cross, not the warrior, not the triumphant. It's not that Paul doesn't have an understanding of those things, but it is very much the Christ crucified. He talks in Corinthians about carrying within him that is who he's embodying.
And the costliness of it. So he's in prison for this letter, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. That's the traditional, as far as we know. He wrote this from prison, so he is literally embodying being someone who's suffering for and with Christ.
And he's also asked us to imitate Timothy.
Yes.
And Epaphroditus.
Yes. So these are leaders to model oneself on. So, of course, there's a whole theme immediately about, you know, we could think about who do we model ourselves on, who inspires us, who do we seek to be like. And I think an acknowledgement here that, you know, while ultimately all these people are also trying to follow Jesus, Jesus can seem either too perfect or too remote. And so we do need human people in our own lifetimes and our own contexts who we can, you know, try and be like to better ourselves. I think we all need that inspiration.
I mean, it's a very fraught area in our image-laden culture and with lots of social media that, you know, like we're sort of – the culture tells us to be authentic and individual and be ourselves, and yet we're bombarded with pictures of perfection or something we're supposed to keep up with. So I'm just naming that it is a fraught and dishonest space, actually.
Yes.
In our world a bit more clearly. But what would it mean to eschew some of those demands and not, you know, and what does imitation and following look like in a noble way? Anyway.
That's right. And in a classic Pauline rhetoric, we're getting to extremes. So the alternative is to kind of live as enemies of the cross. And I think here he's not actually talking about outsiders to the faith. I think he's talking about Christians within the community, the broader community, but who have not got the cross as central. So notice the language is enemies of the cross of Christ, not enemies of Christ, but it's other Christians who don't want to deal with the shame and horror of the cross and just want the good and triumphalist parts. And I mean, I can't help but read this with what's going on in the world again, being a bit political today. You know, we've seen the rise of Christian nationalism around the world, but particularly in America, where, and I say this as a segue to the citizenship stuff, where Christianity has a certain face that is about power and America first.
And masculinity. Usually.
And masculine power, yes. And white masculine power, we might say. And yes, it still looks like Christianity, but it is not this kind of following the cross.
Of self-giving obedience or
yeah, that's
suffering
right.
and openness, opening of emptying of oneself.
Yeah. So yeah. you can see where he goes into verse 19, like their God is the belly. So, you know, the things, human desires, the stuff, the instant gratification, their glory is their shame. So he's acknowledging they have some sort of earthly glory, but he's actually subverting that and saying their glory and power is actually the point of shame for them because they've missed the whole point of the cross. So there's almost like two types of Christianity on display that I think are frighteningly relevant.
At the risk, no, I don't think it does complicate this. I think Brendan Byrne does wonder whether the belly reference is around hedonism or focus on food laws that's really stringent. Mm. But either way, it's a focus on the earthly and, you know, relatively trivial.
Yeah.
Versus the cross and what that calls
it. Yes.
Us out of.
And the citizenship in heaven, I actually love this verse, verse 20. It is political language here. It's the polituma, your citizenship, or we might say allegiance. And again, I don't think Paul here is saying, you know, be heavenly versus earthly.
Out of this world.
Yeah. Yeah, as in float above the earth, not concerned with what's going on here and just be spiritual. But it's actually saying your true allegiance is always to God.
Wherever you are.
Wherever you are, above nation or anything else, right? So,
yeah. I found it helpful to read that the citizens of Rome kept their identity. When they went to live somewhere else or to work there, their name was still kept on the census in Rome.
They were still citizens of Rome.
And they were still primary, that was their identity.
Exactly.
So this is a very familiar image.
Yes.
To be offering people around their relationship with God.
But also you could be living in the Roman Empire and never be the sort of person who could get citizenship. So citizenship of Rome gave you a certain status that a lot of the people Jesus was talking to and Paul was talking to would never aspire to have. So to say you actually have citizenship and it's with God in heaven is a huge promise. It's actually quite radical to say you already have it. But it's not with this empire, it's with God's.
And what a message that is to people whose citizenship, they're not receiving it. You know, they're refugees or they're
fleeing
dangerous places looking for home.
Or they're slaves. Slaves can't be citizens until they're freed or, you know, all of those things. So, a lot here to play with. We need to wrap up. Any last thoughts on what you'd preach this week, Fran?
These ones? I think I'd probably do a mix of the Abraham and this one, which might sound an odd choice, but just that the notion of God putting God's self in the place of violence and at the hands of human beings and triumphing over that and then calling us to a particular serving leadership and an emptying of ourselves would be an angle off the top of – well, not quite off the top of my head, but I'm answering you, that leaps to my mind.
I think I'd either pick up the theme of lament throughout and talk about what it is to lament in with all that's going on and that this is a very biblical notion. Or I do love these images, so I'd be tempted to play with the mother hen and the shield and these sort of non-human images for God. And you could be quite personal about that in terms of the times we felt actually sheltered or protected. There's something about just telling our own stories as preachers.
I think that, now that you
say
that.
Those intimacies with God.
And I think, you know, shield is something that's there in the place of violence, whereas they are images of protection, but they're very different contexts that they happen in,
yes.
I feel like. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be evocative.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.